There's got to be some kind of system to reward the transporters of fuel into our rural communities.
Searching for solutions to the high price of fuel. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 6th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the quest to find a hardy breed of iceworm in Denali National Park.
We're looking for these animals that people have said are there, but really no scientist has documented them.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Harvesting wild game is extremely important to many Alaskans, not only as a food source, but as a long-standing traditional practice. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is committed to maintaining healthy caribou and moose populations. To learn more about the principles and guidelines behind predator management, visit wildlife.alaska.gov or contact your local fish and game office. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska, Department of Fish and Game.
The House late last night approved spending almost $1 billion on pipeline and energy-related needs for the state. However, it delayed passing the bill that contained the specific instructions on what to do with most of that money. Before last night's vote, Finance Co-Chairman Mike Chenault led members through the plan.
There is long-term, medium, and short-term help in this appropriation bill.
The appropriation reflects the governor's resource rebate amount, providing a one-time $1,200 bonus to all Alaskans. It also provides $50 million for gas line development that will eventually go to TransCanada for the North Slope project. And it gives money to the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority to continue work on in-state gas projects. During the two-hour debate, Democrats unsuccessfully attempted to expand the appropriation to include funds for five renewable energy expenses. Lindsay Holmes of Anchorage began with a $150 million appropriation to the Renewable Energy Fund the legislature passed earlier this year.
While we're dealing with this short-term energy relief, trying to keep people from freezing in the dark, please, please, please don't lose sight of the long-term. Mr. Speaker, please don't lose sight of what we're going to do to make life better for the people of Alaska next year, the year after, the year after.
Chenault disagreed, saying the Renewable Energy Fund won't need any money until July of next year. The Senate must concur with the appropriation before the end of the special session tomorrow night. The Alaska Federation of Natives sponsored a roundtable discussion on the escalating energy crisis yesterday at the Captain Cook Hotel. APRN's Eli Meniker was there.
Representatives from AFN, the Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement, and the National Congress of American Indians were all in attendance, as was Senator Ted Stevens, Senator Daniel Inouye of Hawaii, and Governor Sarah Palin. The discussion focused on skyrocketing energy prices and their effects on Native Americans, especially in isolated rural areas. Clarence Jackson, a Tlingit elder, spoke about the high prices in his hometown of Cake in southeast Alaska.
In my village, we're dealing with $6.50 a gallon to heat the home. In my home, that will be $2,100 a month when it gets cold. That's pretty high for an average family.
Other speakers, like Byron Malott, a Tlingit leader and former president of the Alaska Federation of Natives, proposed new ideas to offset the rising oil cost.
What if the Alaska Permanent Fund had allocated by the legislature up to $200 million a year from its income for 5 years and allocated that money to create innovation, sustainability in energy, used it to capture the best minds in Alaska and the best minds available anywhere to spend time in this place and help us create the vision that is being molded as we speak.
Matthew Nicolai, the president and CEO of Chilista Corporation, says one of the key issues in rural areas, particularly southwest Alaska, is the high cost of oil transportation. Nicolai says when fuel is transported from Valdez to Bethel, the price rises by about $1.38 per gallon.
Imagine if we had an incentive for the transport companies that lower that cost down. There must be a way to do that for Bush Alaska. There's got to be some kind of system to reward the transporters of fuel into our rural communities. That way, my relatives in Guihluk will pay the same gasoline cost as Anchorage.
Senator Stevens and Inouye and Governor Palin all talked about ANWR and recommended tapping Alaskan resources to help decrease both our dependence on foreign oil as well as gas prices nationwide.
We certainly are in an energy crisis, and that's absolutely ridiculous to me that we are in this situation when you consider that Alaska is the wealthiest state in the nation, when you consider our natural resources. The energy supplies that we have here that are sitting untapped, in a sense warehoused underground, when we should be and could be developing more and contributing more to the rest of the U.S. with our energy sources.
The various Native groups hope to help craft the new energy plans that will likely be proposed when the U.S. Senate returns to session on September 8th. In Anchorage, I'm Eli Miniker.
While the Palin administration looks for a new commissioner to head up the Department of Public Safety, the current interim commissioner, John Glass, is quietly leading the department. Glass was made acting commissioner after the turmoil that resulted from former Commissioner Walt Monaghan's firing and then the quick resignation of Palin's choice for the next commissioner, Charles Kopp. Kopp quickly resigned because of a sexual harassment complaint that was filed against him more than 2 years ago in Kenai became public. Commissioner Glass has been with the state troopers since 1973. He started his career in Ketchikan. He says the recent shakeup at the department has been tough on morale, but he said public safety professionals are good at recovering from stress.
Our people go through these, well, not specifically this type of turmoil, but we face challenges every day, 24/7. And this is just another challenge, and it's one that we will overcome and move forward.
Glass spent 3 years working in the Bethel region. He says nationwide there are chronic shortages in law enforcement, and filling positions in rural Alaska is especially hard, but he is hopeful for change.
This last session, we were giving an opportunity to support the VPSO program more strongly than what it has been. And that's always our first line of response in some of those villages. We've worked with the VPSOs for years.
The legislative funding was allocated to hire another six VPSO officers and raise the starting pay to $21 per hour. But the program continues to struggle with high turnover and difficult recruitment within the villages. Glass says although he loves his work, he has no desire to stay in the commissioner's position.
I like being out doing the groundwork and being in the background doing that kind of stuff. That's what I am better at than being out in front of things.
Governor Palin has formed a six-person review committee to help find candidates for the commissioner post. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an appropriate memorial for an Alaskan author and photographer.
Michio always wanted to see a blue bear or a glacier bear in the wild, but never did.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo. Manage accounts, pay bills, and get instant loan decisions online at wellsfargo.com. The next stage.
The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Alaska has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has been sexually abused or injured by priests or anyone working for the Fairbanks Diocese. The deadline is December 2, 2008. Claim forms are available online at dioceseoffairbanks.org or by calling 1-888-570-6269. This message is sponsored by the Catholic Bishop of Northern Alaska.
Two biologists are testing their glacier travel skills and their field science expertise on a trek in Denali National Park this week. They're searching for a tiny animal called an ice worm. Scientists have studied them on warmer coastal glaciers for decades. Now they're hoping to find a distant relative that's learned to adapt to an even harsher climate. APRN's Annie Fight caught up with them before they left and has this story.
After the grade school years, most people tend to shy away from all things creepy and slimy, but not Dan Shane.
I'm a worm guy.
Shane is a biology professor at Rutgers University in New Jersey. He's devoted his career to studying simple organisms like leeches and worms, hoping to track their evolutionary path. But on a recent morning, he's studying an immense pile of gear instead, laid out on a lawn in East Anchorage. He just found out his stove doesn't work.
This Coleman stoves, it's always the pump. This part right here. Oop, where'd it go?
Luckily, Shane has the necessary spare part. He's also lucky to have good company on his quest to find ice worms in Denali. He's traveling with Roman Dial, another ice worm biologist based at Alaska Pacific University.
I'm just relying on him to get us to the right places and get us out alive.
Roman Dial is known for punishing himself on extreme expeditions around the world. Last summer, he traveled 600 miles unsupported across the most remote section of Alaska. He says this trip is different because it has a purpose.
We're looking for these animals that people have said are there, but nobody's really, no scientist has documented them. And so I guess, how does it compare? Well, I feel like, I'm using the skills that I use for doing, outdoor adventure, but using it for a scientific purpose.
Ice worms look like thin pieces of black thread about an inch long. Dial says he first spotted them on the Harding ice field more than two decades ago. He saw what looked like pieces of lichen, but they were moving. And he says he was instantly intrigued.
They're neat. They're unique. You know, animals living on glaciers. You go to a glacier and it just seems like this, you know, kind of barren wasteland. And then once you realize that there are organisms living there, and they're very simple ecosystems. They're so simple, you kind of think you can figure them out.
Dial is squeezing several small pack rafts into a large duffel. The group will use the 5-pound boats to float out the chilly Tokositna River back to civilization when the trip is complete.
Glad you're not filming, because I'm not doing a very good job of rolling them up.
The scientists will trek during the day and look for ice worms at night. They're not sure when they'll sleep. As they prepared to head out, the weather forecast was grim, and they were expecting to slog along their route in plenty of cold rain. Dial wasn't worried, though. He says he's gotten pretty good at packing over the years.
I guess, miserable. You can be miserable, but it's always just temporary. You know, you're miserable for a little while, and then you set up your tent and get the stove going. And just hearing the sound of the stove usually mellows me out and makes me feel good. Just that roar, and it relaxes me. And then all the misery goes away, and I feel good.
Rutgers professor Dan Shane has looked for ice worms in Denali once before with no success. But he says that trip suffered from bad timing. He went in the fall when ice worms were probably burrowing deep in the glaciers to ride out the winter. If the Denali worms do exist, Shane says they would have to get around one of the basic ideas of ice worm physiology.
Paradoxically, ice worms are very sensitive to cold temperatures. They freeze right about at the freezing point, just slightly below.
Shane says the coastal glaciers in Alaska are warm glaciers that never freeze completely. But in Denali, they freeze solid and the temperature of the ice plummets well below zero.
In those conditions, an Anchorage ice worm would not survive. It would instantly freeze and die.
Shane would like this trip to answer the question once and for all whether or not ice worms can survive in Denali. But he says he can't guess what they'll find.
Depends on the day. Sometimes I feel like we're probably going to find them. Other days I think about what I know about ice worms and where they can survive. And it just doesn't seem like they're going to be there.
Next summer, Dial and Shane hope to put what they've learned in Denali to use in an even more extreme environment. They've heard ice worms exist on the Tibetan Plateau at 10,000 feet, but they'll have to go there to find out. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
After standing largely unused for the past 8 years, the school in Edna Bay is going through a transformation. It's reopening its doors to students. Edna Bay is a community of roughly 50 year-round residents, and the school closed in 2000. Since mid-July, a team of workers has been bringing it back to life. KSTK's Lisa Fu recently visited Edna Bay's school and has this story.
On a sunny July day on the southeastern corner of Kosciuszko Island, four men are working on replacing the windows of Edna Bay's main school building. This task is just a fraction of what needs to be done. Mike Ash is one of the individuals working on the school. He rattles off the list of other needed improvements.
There's a lot of boardwalks that'll be replaced for the safety entrances and exits. There's going to be new heating systems put in, and we're going to do some sheetrocking. There's going to be new carpet installed.
The Edna Bay School is part of the Southeast Island School District, and according to its superintendent, Lauren Birch, all of these repairs are costing somewhere between $50,000 and $80,000, money that the school district doesn't necessarily have right now. Birch says with a student count of 10, the school is set to receive money from the state. The number of students, or lack of, is why the Edna Bay School closed in 2000. Birch explains how the decision was made to reopen the school this fall.
The decision was reached upon acquiring a hire that had children. You know, that's the plain and simple of it, because you couldn't do it without additional students.
Both Birch and Ash say the community of Edna Bay rallied to get their school reopened. Jeanette Dodson was part of this effort. Her daughter was enrolled in the school when it closed. She and other students had to begin homeschooling. While Dodson's daughter was able to succeed with the PACE correspondence program based out of Craig, there were still some things missing.
Even though she liked homeschooling, it was pretty devastating to not have the school to go to every day, not have not just the interaction, but, you know, you fix your hair and you wear a pretty blouse because you're going to school, you know, that kind of thing.
Dodson stresses that a school is not just important for the students who attend, but also for the community.
Edna Bay has a one-room store and post office. It has a church, and now it'll have the school back again. When it had the school, the school had all sorts of fundraiser functions for the students that were, in essence, social events for the community. It kind of serves a dual purpose because it also ends up being a community center.
Dodson is now raising her grandson, Skyler. While he's too young to enter school this fall, she's hopeful it'll still be open for when he is. Dodson believes the atmosphere of the community will change with the school reopening.
We're very excited about the dynamics of what'll happen once you have active kids and teachers.
At the Sunrise Lodge and General Store, the same building that houses the Edna Bay Post Office, Myla Polstra and her son Taryn hang out behind the register. The Polstras own Edna Bay's only store. 13-year-old Taryn talks about what the school reopening will mean to his family.
Just basically taking the load off my mom, so we won't have to be stuck inside all the time and she'll be able to do other things other than work on my schoolwork all day.
Taryn will be entering the 8th grade on August 26, the first day of school. Myla says Edna Bay School closed right before they moved to the community. Like Dodson, she's anxious to see what will happen to the community once the school reopens and homeschooling is no longer required.
You know, it's really difficult for people to juggle homeschooling. Some people just aren't willing or not able to take it on. This is going to allow people with children to come into the community, and that will really enliven the community. The median age of the community right now is 52 years, so we need some kids.
Even though he's never been to public school before, Taryn says he's not nervous. The only thing he's concerned about is the school staying open long enough for him to graduate. Back at the school, work continues to be done. Ash takes care of vehicle maintenance for the Southeast Island School District, and he's from Kaufman Cove. He's a pastor there, as well as the mayor. For now, though, he's pouring all his effort into making sure the Edna Bay School can reopen this fall.
Lord willing, it will be ready in August.
This is Lisa Fu, reporting in Edna Bay.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Grant Station, finding grants for nonprofit organizations, schools, and governmental agencies throughout the U.S. and Canada. Grant Station, fast track to funding. On the web at grantstation.com.
And by
the State of Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Information about the state's predator management program is available on the web at wildlife.alaska.gov.
Floodwaters have receded at Salcha and Fairbanks, but Nenana is still coping with high water from the Tanana and Nenana rivers. Several Nenana roads remained impassable today. Mayor Jason Mayrand says the flood has affected most of the Park Highway's community of 400.
We're estimating about 80% of the town site was inundated by floodwaters. We had several sections of the community that were under 4 or 5 feet of water. There's still sections that are under around 3 feet of water, but it's getting down. The rivers have dropped, and that's helped with the natural drainage. And we've got pumps all over the community that are working 24 hours a day to help get some of the rest of the water out.
Mehran says it's unclear how many have been forced from their homes, but that a lot of people have gone to stay with friends as far away as Fairbanks until the water recedes. He says dropping water levels will allow a better survey of flood damage. Receding water is enabling some local traffic to resume, but also exposing erosion damage to the community's network of dirt and gravel roads. Billy James with local radio station KIAM says he was able to drive to work this morning.
I park next door, which is the first time I've been able to do that since last week, next door to the station. And I walked over here with my feet up in bags. And the water level got maybe about halfway up to my calves. There's still a lot of ponding and puddling in the ditches. But some of the homes that I could see that looked like the water was right up to their foundation had gone down at least half a foot, if not more.
James says logs and other debris have been strewn across the community by the flood and will have to be cleaned up. No major fuel spills have been reported, but Mayor Mehran says some heating and motor fuel was likely displaced from tanks. It has been a difficult season for fishermen this year, but business in Sandpoint is about to pick up. A new floating processor arrived in town this week, and it's out to prove that it can compete with the traditional processors in town. KSDP's Tony Gorman in Sandpoint reports it could change the landscape of commercial salmon fishing in the area.
To innovate is defined in Merriam-Webster's dictionary as to make changes or do something new. A new processor in Sandpoint will definitely change the culture of commercial salmon fishing in the area. Snowpack Products Incorporated is the new kid on the block. Their floating processor, the Snowpack Innovator, has created a lot of buzz around town since arriving in Sandpoint. That's because the processor's competitive pink salmon prices are giving fishermen a third option along with mainstays Trident Seafoods and Peter Pan Seafoods. Snowpack President Greg Blakey says he sees a lot of potential in the area.
I saw the quality of the fish here, which is far superior to what we get in, not far superior, but it's better fish than what we get in Southeast. And seeing that the, basically, for instance, the pink prices were the lowest in the state, being an ex-fisherman, that really bothered me. And so what I did is I the price we're offering now, the price we're offering is the highest prices in the state because I think the fish are worth it.
Snowpack is a small partner in the up-and-coming Silver Bay Seafoods, which operates in Southeast Alaska. Most of the company's shareholders are fishermen. With a processing plant in Sitka and the Snowpack Innovator working out of Squaw Harbor, the company is looking to expand operations. The company is already building another plant in Craig for next season. Blakey says a Snowpack processing plant could be successful in Sandpoint.
The thing that really impresses me with Sandpoint is I think the business model here would be a lot better than the one in Southeast because there's wintertime fisheries. There's a relatively large amount of pollock, cod, and other species that could be processed in the wintertime. So I think, not to sound simple here, but I think this is a no-brainer.
Blakey says the processor is drawing interest from some local fishermen. Some have already sold fish to Snowpack this season. In Sandpoint, I'm Tony Gorman.
It's been more than a decade since the internationally acclaimed wildlife photographer Michio Hoshino was killed by a grizzly bear. But residents of his native Japan and his adopted homeland of Alaska still mourn his loss. This Friday, a memorial totem pole will be erected in his honor. KCAW's Andy McDaniel reports.
My name is Tommy Joseph, Clankett woodcarver, working here at the Sitka National Historical Park for the Southeast Alaska Indian Cultural Center.
Tommy Joseph has crafted nearly 30 full-size totem poles over the years, but the one he's putting the finishing touches on today is a little different. For one thing, it features an animal Joseph has never carved before.
A raven, a caribou, and a humpback whale. These are all Michio subjects, animals that he photographed in throughout Alaska. All but the bear on top, the glacier bear, also known as the blue bear. Our thoughts behind putting the blue bear on the top of the pole. Michio always wanted to see a blue bear or a glacier bear in the wild, but never did. So the thoughts was putting the blue bear on the top out of Michio's reach, as in real life.
The purpose of the pole is to honor the life of Michio Hoshino, a photographer and writer who was incredibly dear to both his family and his fans. Hoshino was born in Japan but spent 26 years in Alaska. His photographs of the state's unique wildlife and landscapes have attracted thousands of Japanese tourists here to see for themselves. Sitkin Bob Sam was a close friend of Hoshino's and recalls a man who experienced nature in a way not often seen.
He could sit in one spot for hours, if not days, just waiting for that perfect photo out in nature. When I was camping with him, we would very rarely talk at all.
It was Bob Sam who came up with the idea to erect a totem pole. He says the idea is not to put Hoshino the person on a pedestal.
This totem pole isn't actually for Michio, but to honor the work that he has done to document nature in Alaska.
The carving of the totem pole has taken several months, but even before Tommy Joseph made the first cut, other factors had to fall into place, such as gaining the support of the environmental community. Bob Sam again.
I didn't think about the other part where the tree would actually get sacrificed. That created kind of some tension in the environmental community who feel that Michio wouldn't want a tree to be sacrificed for him.
Ultimately, the World Temperate Rainforest Coalition contributed financially to the project. Other funding came from supporters in Japan, many of whom contributed through the Japanese magazine Coyote. Carver Tommy Joseph has invested thousands of personal dollars in making the pole project happen. The actual logistics were another hurdle. Tommy Joseph led that phase.
It took 6 hours of driving log roads with a Forest Service representative, and he brought me, showed me where the trees were, the different stands of red cedar, and I picked out three trees, and then they ultimately told me which one I could have. Then I had to hire a logger to fell the tree, get it out of the forest, and deliver it to a loading dock.
The final product will be erected August 8th near Magic Island at the Halibut Point Recreation Area. Bob Sam hopes the experience will be positive for those who loved Hoshino.
The very simple act of putting up a totem pole and walking away will allow us to move on with our own lives. Because a lot of people really still grieve his loss of his life.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Andy McDaniel.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Lisa Fu in Wrangell, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tony Gorman in Sandpoint, and Andy McDaniel in Sitka. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau, and Eli Menneker from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Profit is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
And by
the State of Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Information about the state's predator management program is available on the web at wildlife.alaska.gov.
APRN would like to thank the Alaska Railroad Corporation for sponsoring Alaska Morning News and Alaska News Nightly. To learn more about this sponsorship, call 907-550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.